So I think we can start today's session. So I welcome all of you for sutta teaching session. So we are discussing several suttas which are more relevant to our practice. And we have already discussed Sabbasava Sutta, and then we are now discussing Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta is coming in the Majjhima Nikaya, the third book. Majjhima Nikaya has three books, and in the third one, where most of the analysis are included, and that is where Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta is included. So, as you can see in the screen, so in this sutta, Buddha is giving several explanations about this so-called person, so-called man, so-called woman, and the so-called individual. And the first explanation is, this person consists of six elements. The earth element, air element, water element, fire element, space element, and the consciousness element. And among them, actually four elements are quite common to us. We are using it in our practice. Say for example, if you are practicing Dhatu Manasikara, the elements meditation, so these four elements are the most dominant characteristics, so we are trying to recognize these four elements. And then space element actually is not much taken in the vipassana practice, but on the other hand, the consciousness element, so in this sutta, consciousness element is considered or explained with respect to its functionality. So that is the recognition of various feeling tones, either painful feelings, happy feelings, or neutral feelings, neither painful nor pleasant feelings. So that is one important function of consciousness, and with respect to that, consciousness element is explained. And then the six bases of contact, so eye with forms, ear with sounds, nose with smells, tongue with taste, body with tactile sensations, and the mind with mind objects. So these are the ways that any human being, any celestial being, and any say other beings which are keeping earth as their habitant, so all of they have any of these senses, and with that they do all the communication, they do all the reception and the connection with the outside world. So, with respect to that, Buddha analyzing this so-called person, so-called individual, and he says, this so-called person is nothing but six base of contact. And then 18 kinds of mental exploration. So, that is how our mind works. Especially when we encounter various, as we discuss various sense impingements. So, when we see something through our eyes, any kind of a sight. So we are searching more and more information, more and more detail in order to gratify our senses, in order to be happy, in order to be more and more happy. So as a result, kind of a mental exploration is happening. On the other hand, if we see something we don't like, something which is sorrowful, still the eye may be used to explore more details, even though we get more unhappy. And on the other hand, there may be many instances that we see various things which doesn't make any happy feeling nor painful feeling, but still some neutral feeling. But we may explore more details so that the neutral feeling becomes predominant. So likewise, with respect to the eyes, so we can use the eye in order to search more and more detail, and the outcome is either pleasant or painful or neutral feelings. Similarly, we are using other senses. So therefore, Buddha explains this so-called person is 18 types of or 18 kinds of mental explorations. So those we have discussed, and then we get on to one of the important point, that is number four, has four foundations. So now from this point onwards, Buddha is taking us in the vipassana approach, vipassana practice, and it is very much like the vipassana practitioner can be analyzed or can be viewed as that he is possessing four foundations. So these four foundations are not the typical mindfulness foundations, that is the satipatthana, but here these four foundations are more broader, and satipatthana can be included inside these four foundations. So these four foundations are actually the wisdom foundation, and then the saccha foundation. So these four foundations, would they say, foundation of wisdom, foundation of truth, foundation of relinquishment, and foundation of peace. So it appears like we couldn't understand what Buddha is trying to tell here, like little confusing, but that's why we are trying to go through it carefully, so that it has a lot of relevance to our practice. So say for example, if we consider the foundation of wisdom, so this is where the whole fair amount of vipassana practice is involved. So we have to understand what Buddha is trying to teach us. So what are his explanations about this so-called person, and accordingly we should try our best to understand according to that teaching. So it may not be just going through a book or listening to a Dhamma sermon and then trying to understand, but we have to practice, we have to sharpen our certain faculties, and accordingly we have to practice so that we may be able to understand what Buddha is trying to point it out. So that is where, with respect to wisdom, Buddha says one should not neglect wisdom. So one should not neglect wisdom, emphasize that we have to sort of try our best to understand Buddha's teaching in a way. So that we discuss in length. So what is here, what Buddha is mentioning, like the foundation of wisdom. So therefore, this foundation of wisdom one should not neglect. And in that sense, we have to try our best to understand it. So there Buddha is explaining this foundation of wisdom with respect to six elements. Earth element, water element, then the fire element, and then the air element, and then he get on to space element, and ultimately to the consciousness element. So under consciousness element, as I mentioned before, so the feeling is taken to the front. That is one of the important function of the consciousness, and therefore how one can understand various feelings. And on the other hand, this is very much the Vedana Anupassana, the foundation of the feelings, and that is how Buddha is explaining this consciousness element, the, with respect to its functionality. And then actually when this is preached to Venerable Pukkusati, he is already having some concentration, and he is able to understand what Buddha is trying to tell him, and he is using his mind according to his teaching, and he was able to realize most of this information, most of these facts. So, and then Buddha is giving another sort of a point to give up absorptions, to give up jhana, and pointing one's mind, or turning one's attention towards the unconditioned, that is the Nibbana. So this is another important fact this sutta highlights. So we can presume that Venerable Pukkusati already has these absorptions, these jhanas, and he is fond of spending time in these jhanas, and now Buddha is turning his attention towards the Nibbana, not into the jhana. So Buddha is telling here that these jhanas are conditioned, they actually have to be thought of, we have to determine, we have to intentionally prepare them, intentionally we have to absorb to them. So likewise, and again, they are impermanent, and therefore they are unsatisfactory, and they are out of our control. So likewise, the consequences or the disadvantages of jhana are being mentioned to Venerable Pukkusati, and accordingly his attention being driven or turned towards the Nibbana. So here we can understand that Buddha teaching him mostly to the Vipassana approach, because he is already having, the Venerable Pukkusati is already having a fair amount of concentration. Now it's a matter of developing the Panya, the wisdom. As you know, Sila Samadhi Panya is the typical approach of the teaching, of the practice. So one has to establish oneself in morality, and then he is using that morality to further develop concentration, and that concentration being utilized to develop wisdom. Now wisdom is the aspect of this preaching. So Buddha therefore turning Venerable Pukkusati's attention towards the wisdom, towards the Nibbana, and that is mentioned in this part. So how one has to give up various absorptions and then turning towards the unconditioned or the Nibbana. So when one is able to recognize the state of Nibbana, when one is able to recognize at least the non-attachment in the mind, so it's a kind of a mind state. And when one is practicing mindfulness, when one is practicing Vipassana, so one would be able to recognize that state of mind. Say for example, if we consider Satipatthana Sutta, so each and every Kamatahan, each and every meditation object, Buddha emphasizes this state where one has to maintain one's mind unassociated and not attached with anything in the world, not grasping anything in the world. So this sort of a state one has to recognize, and that has to be maximized. So our mind has not trained to stay in such situation, rather mind is trained to grasp, to crave, to attach. So therefore this new state could be little alienated to us, little foreign to us. So therefore one has to cultivate one's mind to further develop that state, to further protect that state if one is able to maintain it. So that is the topic that Buddha is taking as this next topic. So that is where the foundation of truth, and that has to be preserved. So as I said, there are four foundations. The first foundation is the wisdom foundation, and now Buddha is explaining the second foundation, that is the foundation of truth. So you can see, I mean, these four foundations are a little difficult to understand at the beginning, but we'll see how much beautifully Buddha is using these four foundations to explain the path to Nibbana. So that's why this sutta is very relevant and very interesting in a way, how Buddha is analyzing this whole path, this Vipassana path, in terms of four foundations. And when one establishing four foundations, what would be the outcome? How such a person would behave? All these things are explained in this sutta. Therefore, this sutta is quite interesting. And so with respect to this foundation of truth, so Buddha says, the one who is establishing this wisdom foundation, then he has the deliverance. He is able to maintain a kind of a freedom of mind. And this freedom of mind, so this is the truth. So this is unshakable. So we'll see more and more why Buddha is making such a statement. And if anything is of deceptive nature, if anything is sort of not real, then it is basically false. And on the other hand, if something is undeceptive, and that can be considered as truth, and that is the Nibbana. And therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this truth possesses the supreme foundation of truth, and Nibbana is the supreme noble truth which has an undeceptive nature. So this is the sort of short explanation given in this sutta with respect to the Nibbana, and that is being considered as the truth, and that truth has to be preserved. So we can find out why Buddha is making such a statement, and why such a state has to be preserved, Well, that is quite important. So these are things that we can discuss in practical sense. Say, for example, as we discussed in Satipatthana Sutta last time, so when one is developing Satipatthana, mindfulness practice, so one would be able to recognize, say, one's state of mind. Say, whether it is attached with the rupa, whether it is attached with the perceptions, or sankhara, the formations, or feelings. So likewise, there may be various points where the mind can attach. On the other hand, the consciousness can establish. But when one develops mindfulness, one would be able to recognize that. And not immediately, but slowly, when we are developing a particular path, a particular practice, these kind of aspects going to be a little evident to oneself. May not be immediately, but slowly. So these information or these establishments would going to be slowly available to oneself, and therefore one can understand where the mind is stated, or where the mind is attached, where the mind is established. First of all, actually, we have to establish ourselves in the present moment. So otherwise, we are very much like deceived, or very much like not in the present moment, very much like in a dream. Say we are thinking about the past, regretting about the past, or maybe planning the future. We may be in a sort of uncertainty, since we are thinking too much about the future. So likewise, so those very interesting, very attractive past and the future always take us out of the present moment. So we are not in the present moment, we lose the present moment. So we are in a dream world, not in the real reality. So therefore, first of all, we have to establish ourselves in the present moment. So that would be the first step in mindfulness practice. So that's why we are, say for example, teaching yogis to keep your attention on the breath, or keep your attention on the rising and falling of the abdomen, or keep your attention on the foot. So we are trying to take ourselves to the present moment. It may be sitting, it may be walking, it may be lying down, or any other day-to-day activity. One can try to take one's attention to this present moment, what the body is doing at the moment. So that would be the easiest approach, because body can only be in the present moment. So various bodily processes are available, and all these bodily processes are happening in the present moment. So therefore, yogi's attention is taken towards these bodily processes, and as a result, mind also start to stay in the present moment. Mind is now trained to be in the present moment with the help of these bodily processes. Say for example, you are practicing mindfulness on breathing. So each and every breath happens in the present moment. So one is trying to be mindful on the in-breath. One is trying to be mindful on the out-breath. So if one maximizes this process, so mind is slowly trained to present, or to be in the present moment, and that is attached with the breath. So breath actually is a kind of a means, kind of a tool for us to bring our attention to the present moment. Otherwise, mind drifts, or mind distracts towards the past or the future. So this is a kind of a mechanism, this is a kind of a strategy one is using to train the mind to come back to the present moment. Suppose one is able to accomplish this, then for continuous period of time, say half an hour, 45 minutes, one's mind can be kept in the present moment. So Buddha does not stop us there, so he is further asking us to refine our mindfulness. So how one can properly recognize the details of this present moment object, say the breath. So whether it is long, whether it is short, whether it is coming from left nostril, or whether it is going out from the right nostril, or whether it is whether the in-breath is cold or the out-breath is hot. So likewise, there are various minute details, very subtle details one can recognize when the mindfulness is refined. Typically, we call it as sampajanya, clear comprehension, where we can clearly recognize, clearly understand various aspects of this object which is on our attention. So the breath itself is a kind of a subtle phenomena. So if one is able to recognize its more refined details, as we have discussed already, so this indicates that one's mindfulness and clear comprehension has improved. So as a result of that, so one is more and more expanding one's mindfulness. Say one is trying to establish mindfulness while walking. One is trying to establish one's mindfulness while standing, while lying down. And even say while eating, say one while wearing our clothes. So likewise, one has to expand one's mindfulness. So just sitting, just walking may not be enough. So one has to expand one's mindfulness so that fair amount of unbroken mindfulness would be available for oneself. So there one will understand, okay, at these activities I didn't have mindfulness, but on the other hand, other activities mostly I had mindfulness. So one can understand mindfulness as a faculty, as a sort of a characteristics in the mind, as a quality of the mind. So at the beginning we didn't know what is mindfulness, but later one can understand what is mindfulness is, when mindfulness is not present, when one is unmindful, and when one is mindful. So one can now understand in one's own mind what is the quality of mindfulness. So this is important. So, and then Buddha is taking us further to understand the understand these phenomena, how they really behave. Are they permanent? Are they existing for a long time? Or are they quite transient? So likewise, we are being sort of invited to investigate these phenomena, these present phenomena. It may be breath, it may be various elements, it may be various feelings, it may be various perceptions, it may be various thoughts. So any of these phenomena one can properly observe in order to understand their behavior. So then one will understand, okay, they are quite transient, constantly they are subject to arising and passing away, therefore they are very much unsatisfactory. One cannot expect lasting happiness from this kind of a transient series of phenomena, series of functions, processes, and on any of these things are mostly out of our control. They don't behave as we like. So we simply have to, when one is able to understand this kind of scenario, one's mind start to get detached. So basically Buddha's teaching, Buddha highlights that if one has this proper understanding, seeing things as they truly are, that actually will lead to dispassion, that actually will lead to disenchantment. So rather than grasping, rather than holding, rather than desiring, one is now trying to let go of, one is releasing one's hand, one's mind become relaxed, one's mind become free. So this is the next step. So where one's mind now understand a state where there is a possibility of non-attachment, there's a possibility of non-grasping, there's a possibility of unassociation. Mind doesn't need to associate anything. Mind has its own capacity to stay independent, stay free. So this is the state one may recognize as a result of practice. Now, so this state actually appear like boring, actually appear like monotonous, because there are no activities there. So mind get released, mind get non-attached, sorry, there is nothing to hold on to. So one may feel like lost one's direction, lost one's sort of address, lost one's location, because mind so far was trained, was habitually sort of trained to grasp something, to attach something, to hold something. But with the practice, now the mind tends to release everything, to give up everything, to let go of everything, and to stay alone, and to stay free. to associate nothing. So this is a kind of a strange state to us. So therefore, typically we neglect it. Typically we leave it aside. We think it is not a useful state. We think this is a kind of a boring state. We think it is not a useful, and there is nothing to preserve there. But on the other hand, Buddha is advising, okay, this is the kind of outcome of the practice. So that one has to preserve, that one has to protect, that one has to give some emphasis. So that is where in Satipatthana practice, each and every kammatthana, the meditation object, ends up with emphasizing this state. Anissitocha viharati, nachakinchi loke upadhyati. One should now live without attaching to anything in the world, without grasping anything in the world. So this is kind of a state that one has to practice. This is a kind of a state one has to preserve, where one has to train one's mind to stay. Rather than neglecting it, one has to train one's mind to maintain. So this is where Buddha is emphasizing. So consider this state as the truth. Consider this is the most important state. So typically our mind never appreciates such state, because typically what we appreciate is where our conceit being sort of imposed, when there's a self view is imposed, when there's an identity being imposed, when there's an individuality is imposed. But on this kind of a state, this kind of a non-attached, non-grasping state, such identity, such grasping, such importance, such conceit is not there. So as a result, it appears like utterly boring, utterly useless, and utterly monotonous. So therefore, we don't care about it. We simply leave it aside. So that's why Buddha is emphasizing here to give some value to it and to preserve it. And I like to take your attention to some other suttas, a part of certain other suttas, so that where Buddha again and again highlighted this point. Say, for example, in Dvaitanupassana Sutta, Buddha is telling anattani attamani passa lokang sadevakang nivittang nama rupasming idang satchanti manyati. So Buddha, like in a sympathetic way, telling us the behavior of everybody, not only the humans but even the devas, how these the fools are behaving. Buddha is telling, behold the world together with its devas, conceiving a self, it is not a real self, but conceiving a self, where there is only non-self. Settled upon name and form, they conceive this is true. Now, some of you may have some idea about what I am trying to tell here. So, if one is able to experience unattached state of mind, non-grasping state of mind, so at that time mind is free, mind is empty, there is nothing to hold, kind of a spaciousness is there. And again, it is quite simple, it is not a very complicated, complex state of mind, but rather extremely pure, extremely pleasant, or extremely spacious, empty kind of a state. And on that state, there is no self at all. There is no identity at all. But we don't consider that as anything truth. But we consider when mind is colored, when mind is on some kind of a grasping, when mind is associating something. So that associated state, that attached state, that grasping state, we typically consider as truth. So there we find a self. So I attach to something, I attach to her, I love her, I fond of that, I like that. So every time the self view is generated, when there is this kind of an attachment, when there is this kind of an association. So the association actually leads to the self view. the self-view being reinforces because of this kind of an attachment. But when there is nothing to attach, when the mind is utterly free, when the mind is empty, so this identity view, this self-view is no more there. This is still temporary. It is not that this is a kind of a last state, but still it is temporary. But at least temporary, the mind is free. At least temporary, mind is unattached. So when during that state, when the mind is getting some sort of a sign, some sort of a mental object, some sort of a mental image, so we immediately think this is true. Say for example, your mind is kept empty, spacious. At that time you remember your son, you remember your daughter, you remember your mother, you remember your father, you remember your wife, you remember your husband, whatever it is. So just a sign going to appear in the mind. So we immediately think, okay, this is true. This is so and so. This is my son. This is my daughter. So likewise, we are attributing a self, we are attributing an individuality to this mental image. So we are giving life to this mental image. So we consider this mental image is something quite important. We consider this mental image as something true. But basically, Buddha says all these mental images, all these signs are merely mirages. Merely mirage. Not real water. They are not the truth. They are not the reality. But they are simply a mirage. But we unfortunately get deceived by these mirages. And we think that we are quite intelligent, only the deers go after the mirage. But unfortunately, we are even foolish than the deers. We constantly, various thoughts come into the mind, various mental images come into the mind. Constantly we consider everything is true. Everything, to everything I am liable, everything I am responsible. I have to function according to all these mental images. I have to give value to them. So we start proliferating, we start making stories, all the inner chatter going to start. So we create a self, we create an incident, we create a person. So this is the typical scenario. So considering this, therefore Buddha says, see these fools, humans and the devas, just considering all this name and form appearing in the mind, they consider it as true, it has important, it has a lot of value, and they get grasped to it. They get attached to it. Then the consciousness go and establish on this name and form. And the another verse in the same Dvaitanupassana Sutta, Buddha says, Amosa dhammang nibbana, tadariya satchato vidu, teve satchabhi samaya nichata parinibbutati. So Nibbana is of non-false nature. Nibbana is of true nature, and that the noble ones know as truth. So it doesn't have any coming and going. It doesn't have any arising and passing away. It doesn't have any attachment. It doesn't have grasping. It doesn't have any individual. It doesn't have any person. It doesn't have any self. And the nobles consider that as the truth. And by using it, by preserving that truth, one is breaking through the whole samsara. And they become completely free from the samsara. And they are able to quench the craving. They are able to remove craving by utilizing, by preserving this truth more and more in one's mind. So, and again, I like to highlight another aspect that Buddha is actually highlighting to the nature of the mind. Here, if we consider in this one beautiful statement by the Buddha, where Buddha says, Pabassaramidam bhikkave chittang tanchako agantukehi upakkilesehi upakkilittang. So basically what he says is that luminous bhikkhus is this mind. So this is the kind of an original nature of the mind. But unfortunately, it is being covered by this strange defilements, this alien defilements. So if one is able to remove this outer layer, because of that, the mind is polluted, mind is covered, so one would be able to touch this luminous nature. One would be able to touch this pure nature. One would be able to touch this unattached nature of the mind. So therefore Buddha emphasized, so it is not something we are trying to import this to the mind. This is what available in the mind. But we are simply swimming in the surface. We are simply struggling in the surface. We are simply being drawn to these various sense impingements. How about coming back home? How about coming back and staying in the emptiness? How about coming back and staying in the pure awareness? So that is the original nature. So that is Buddha is telling us to simply trust him at the beginning. And with the trust on the Buddha and with the trust of the Dhamma and the Sangha, so one is trying to explore that state of mind through the practice. Suppose one is able to recognize such state, then one has to preserve that state. One has to preserve that luminous state. One has to preserve that pure, unattached, unassociated, empty state. Empty in the sense, empty of a self, empty of defilements, empty of self-view, empty of self-individuality. So that is where the emptiness is. It is not something sort of negative, but rather it is a very rich empty state. And again, so in this certain other suttas, Buddha is mentioning all the defiled state of minds arise attached with kind of a nimitta, kind of a sign. If the mind is free from nimitta, free from signs, then that is completely wholesome. So this is another statement Buddha is making. Sanimitta bhikkave uppajjanti papaka akusala dhamma no animitta. Sanimitta bhikkave uppajjanti papaka akusala dhamma no animitta. Tasseva nimittassa pahana evante papaka akusala dhamma na honti. So if one is able to remove all these signs, all these nimittas, all these mental objects, all these mental images, so then mind is completely free, completely empty, completely pure, completely clean. On such situation, none of these akusala states, none of these unwholesome states are possible to arise. So one would be able to maintain one's mind in this complete wholesomeness. So what I want to highlight here is that the path, whatever is practiced, which is leading towards this kind of an empty mind, this kind of an unattached mind, unassociated mind, free mind, is taking us more towards the Nibbana, more towards the freedom, more towards kind of a calmness, kind of peace. So this peace, therefore Buddha says, has to be preserved. It is not that one has to neglect it. It is not that you going to immediately have it for your lifetime. But it is very much very short-lived at the beginning, because our mind is not trained to stay there. Our mind is constantly trained to attach to something, to hold something, to possess something. But here, there is nothing there, nothing to possess, nothing to hold, nothing to grasp. So such state therefore appear like negative, appear like boring, appear like monotonous. So that is why Buddha is so much giving emphasis to that state and asking us to preserve it, asking us to familiarize with it, asking us to register it in our mind. So that is why Buddha is telling that state is the true state. The other transient states are quite false, because they appear like true, but because of their transiency, because of their impermanence, they completely become something else. So when we think something as true, it has to be true forever. But when we think something as true for only for a short time, then it is turned into something else, change into something else, then how can we consider such transient state as truth? Say for example, there is a kind of image appear in the mind, and that going to be changed, that the color going to be changed, the frame or the form going to be changed, the shape going to be changed. So everything going to be changed. So which state are we going to consider as the truth? So when something is constantly changing, so which state are we going to be considered as truth? So there we can say, so it is not possible to impose kind of a truth to a changing phenomena. So if we have to consider something as truth, so it has to be truth forever. And it has to be truth for me, and it has to be truth for someone else, to you, to everyone. So it cannot be true only for a certain group of people, and to someone else it is false. So truth has to be truth for everyone. Truth has to be truth forever. So likewise, Buddha is arguing here, so the state of Nibbana is the truth state. That is the true state. Whatever else, whatever subject to change, is not true. So when we are imposing some self, so that cannot be considered as true because it's going to change. Say for example, I'm just to give you a mundane example. Say for example, a person born as a human being in this life. So he considered this life is beautiful, this life is important. So I am a human, I am a man, I am so and so, I have these important, I have these titles, I have these degrees. So whatever it is. So he is imposing, he is attributing a lot of information, a lot of detail, a lot of titles to him, and he is a person, he is a self. But suppose he is born as an animal on next life. So as Buddhists, we all believe the rebirth. So suppose this person is going to reborn as a dog on next life. So at that state of mind, so that dog may believe, okay, this dog form is the truth. This is important. I have four legs. I can bark. So likewise, that his nature become entirely different now. So which state is the true state? So every time, whatever is the form, whatever is the present life, we are born. So we consider this as the truth. This is important. And when someone who is capable of seeing all these series of lives, so he can understand all these series of lives are entirely transient. This very short-lived. This human realm is a short-lived. Maybe 50 years, 100 years, that's it. Maybe a dog's life is transient. It's just a 5-6 years. Maybe another ant's life. Maybe a few seconds even, or one day. So likewise, one can consider, even this, through this mundane example, none of these life states are permanent. None of these life states going to last for a long time. So as a result, so can we consider this is something satisfactory? Can we consider that there is a self in this transient state? So these are something that we can reflect. These are something we can think of, so that we can, I mean, when we think like that, we can apply this understanding more in a more refined manner to our practice. So when one is able to recognize one's own breath, how transient it is, how quickly it is arising and passing away, how quickly it is changing. And to such changing phenomena, how are we going to attribute a self? How are we going to attribute a person? So there we end up with that it is impossible. It is impossible to consider it as truth because it is constantly changing. So if it is possible to be free from all this transient nature, if it is possible to leave aside all these conditioned phenomena and would able to maintain one's mind unconditioned, unattached, non-grasping, and then that is an entirely different domain. That's an entirely different, experience. So that Buddha says is the true state, to develop that state, to preserve that state, and to maintain one's mind more and more in that state. So this is something Buddha is highlighting in the second foundation of truth, that is the foundation of the second foundation in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, that is the foundation of truth, and there Buddha is emphasizing that it has to be preserved. So with that concluding remark, I like to sum up today's Dhamma sermon or the Sutta teaching. Now I open the session for questions.
Thank you, Bhante. So maybe I'll start with questions relating to today's Dhamma talk first, and then I can circle back to last week's question.
Yeah.
So one of the question is a woman, an empty mind, a state, could be the background in which deep dormant defilements appear. Example, anusaya asakshan. There's the second part, which is, and hence mind state will help us to see and uproot such dormant defilements. Is this accurate?
We can say that this original nature is common to everyone and available, but it is covered, as we discussed in the sutta. So when one is able to recognize such state, so one is having kind of a reference point. One is able to having some kind of a able to do some kind of a comparison, because if one doesn't know what is pure, if one doesn't know what is clean, then there is no way of purifying oneself. Say, for example, when you know that there's a cloth is sort of not clean, so one can use maybe a detergent, soap, one can clean it. Then one can experience the pure, clean cloth. So again, suppose the cloth get sort of dirty. Then again, one can compare, okay, it was clean, it was pure, it was white, but now again it become dirty, again become polluted. Now likewise, when time to time, when one is able to recognize a pure mind, one is able to recognize a clean mind, unattached mind. So that is giving some kind of a reference to one's mind, for one's practice. So whenever a defilement arises in that pure state, it's easily visible. One can easily recognize, okay, this is the beginning of lust. This is the end. This is the middle of lust. This is the ending of lust. This is the beginning of anger. This is the middle of anger. This is the end of anger. So one can clearly recognize or clearly understand the behavior of all these defiled states of mind. Say, for example, then in Dhammanupassana, Buddha very clearly says, so when there is no lust, one understand now the mind is free from lust. When there is lust, one understand, okay, there is lust. And when there is lust arising in the mind, one can understand, okay, now the mind is, then now the lust is arising in the mind. And when one is simply giving it up, one is not promoting it, one is not fertilizing it, now the lust is going, lust is fading away. That also one can understand. So once lust has gone, there is no more lust in the mind, now again the mind is free, that also can be understood. So likewise, so all these defilements, actually how they going to manifest, how they going to behave, how they are arising, how they are changing, how they are passing away, how we get caught, how we are fertilizing them. So all this picture, all this behavior become evident when we are able to recognize that pure state of mind, unattached state of mind. So it is not that immediately one would be able to recognize anusaya asava, but rather when we see the see how these anusaya and asava, the latent tendencies, going to manifest, going to come their active state. So they actually manifest and they come to active state, and then we can recognize. then we can recognize, okay, this is actually a lust, this is actually anger. But the roots, we can say, okay, towards the lust, this is raga anusaya. For the anger, this is the patiga anusaya. Since we had raga anusaya, since we had patiga anusaya, so that is why they are manifesting. That is why this kind of turbulence has happened. So I hope that I have answered the question. So anything else? Who's this? Did I answer the question, or is there anything not answered?
The person responded yes, very clear, Bhante.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the next question that I have. So in the sutta, Buddha mentioned about the function of consciousness in relation to vedana and upasana, but the Buddha did not mention about dhamma and upasana. How does Dhamma Nupassana fit into these four foundations mentioned in this sutta?
So typically Dhamma Nupassana means that one understands various states of the mind. Say, not only the mind, actually we can consider the whole five khandhas. So Dhamma Nupassana included the understanding about hindrances, understanding about sense contact, ayatana, and the understanding about khandhas, the aggregates, understanding about Four Noble Truths. So all are included in Dhamma Nupassana. So all this Dhamma Nupassana section is scattered throughout this sutta. We can say, for example, when Buddha is telling about six elements, so there we can say, okay, certain amount of form, that the rupakhanda is included, certain amount of consciousness khanda is included, the feeling khanda, the vedana khanda is included, and when Buddha is telling about the six bases of contact, that's another explanation Buddha is giving. So they are the ayatana pabba of Dhamma Nupassana. We can say it is included. And on the other hand, when one is practicing consciousness element, as you said, Vedana Nupassana is included. And Buddha doesn't stop there. Rather, Buddha is giving some emphasis towards this, the foundation of truth. And there we can say the next stage, all the outcomes, all the results of each and every Anupassana, which is coming in the Satipatthana, is also included. So we are therefore very much like Dhamma Anupassana is included in the sutta. And again, the Four Noble Truths. So under the Four Noble Truths, the one important aspect is the Third Noble Truth, the Nirodha Satcha. So the Nirodha Satcha is highlighted as the foundation of truth, the second foundation here in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. So we can therefore admit that four foundations, or the four Satipatthanas, are included in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, but in a different way. This is a kind of a different analogy or different preaching style that Buddha has taken in this Dhamma, in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. It's also very beautiful in a way, because Buddha is approaching the situation in a different angle and giving us a different picture about the freedom.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. I believe that is all of the questions directly relating to today's Dhamma talk. If anyone has any other questions, feel free to send them via chat or raise your hand to ask directly. So Bhante, may I start with last week's unanswered questions?
Sure.
Okay. When experiencing and being in equanimity, how can Vedana Nupassana be practiced?
Yeah, say for example, you are practicing Anapanasati. So the whole and the majority of time, your mind is in equanimity. But you are looking at the phenomena. You are looking at how in breath happens, we are looking at how out breath happens. So likewise, equanimity does not mean that it is entirely free from any incidents, entirely free from any phenomena. All the processes, all the activities happening, but it doesn't generate any happy feeling, it doesn't generate any painful feeling, rather it generates an equanimous feeling. So therefore, when you are associating equanimity, it doesn't mean that there is nothing for you to contemplate, nothing for you to know. There are enough things are available for you to contemplate. So only thing is that we have to have a refined mindfulness. If our mind is scattered, if our mind is distracted towards the past and the future, so we may not be able to recognize these subtle phenomena. But when our mindfulness is refined, then recognizing these equanimous phenomena, equanimous feelings would be possible. Even the, say, rising and falling, it's an equanimous kind of a feeling. Say you are doing some walking meditation, mostly it is equanimous. So, but still all these processes can be recognized.
Thank you, Panke. And the next question, after identifying different feelings, how does it help to purify the mind?
Yeah, actually, more and more you recognize these feelings, you are going to understand the nature of them. So typically, we consider all these belong to me. I am suffering. I am happy. I feel bored. I feel monotonous. So all these, we attribute a self to the feeling. But when we are looking at these feelings objectively, so then this identification going to be broken. So we are able to recognize feeling as feeling, present feeling as present feeling, painful feeling as painful feeling, equanimous feeling as equanimous feeling. They are not me, they are not mine, they are not myself, they are merely feelings. And they arise with respect to or due to contact. Whenever a contact which is conducive of producing a pleasant feeling, now a pleasant feeling arises. When there is a contact which is conducive of generating a painful feeling, now the painful feeling arises. So likewise, so one is understanding more deeply how the feelings are arising, how they are changing, how they are, what are the causes for them to arise, and how they are passing away, and how transient they are, and how much they are under, out of your control. So more and more you enhance this kind of an understanding, this kind of a wisdom, so the grasping towards the wisdom going to be broken, grasping towards the feelings going to be faded away. So there's a kind of a disenchantment, non-grasping towards the feeling. So likewise, the mind going to be purified. Now mind is letting go. Now mind know the real nature of all feelings. Now you don't need to go and grasp a happy feeling. Now you don't need to wish for happy feelings. Now you don't need to get rid of painful feelings. Now you don't need to be sort of ignored this equanimous feelings. Rather, you are using all of these feelings to further improve your mindfulness, further improve your wisdom. And so this become kind of a wisdom practice where you are using feelings to improve your wisdom. So as a result, more and more the feelings appear like distant from you, kind of a distance is generated between the observing mind and the feelings. And as a result, kind of a detachment going to arise. Now mind become free. Now mind is coming up with a state which is not attaching with any feeling. It doesn't want to grasp any happy feeling, not afraid of painful feeling, not getting deluded by neutral feelings. Rather mind knows that they are coming and going. I have no control over them. They doesn't belong to me. So that is how the mind starts to purify.
Thank you, Francis. Next question, I believe this is related to today's Dhamma talk. You said when one feels disenchanted with objects and feelings, etc., one experiences that state as a boring state in one's life. What is your advice to someone who feels somewhat detached from worldly pleasures and someone who has a lesser degree of self? Because when there is a lesser degree of self, the motivation that was there earlier to better yourself for a future life disappears. Thank you.
Could you repeat the last statement?
Yes, the last statement is, because when there is a lesser degree of self, the motivation that was there earlier to better yourself for future life disappears.
Yeah, true, true. So basically, I mean, when we have some sort of a motivation, so then we get elated, then we get sort of activated. But these kind of states, mental states are sort of, they don't agitate us. They don't give much motivation because they are kind of peace. They are kind of peaceful. They are kind of, there is no agitation, kind of empty. So therefore, it appears like boring. And again, so these states doesn't promote a self, doesn't promote an individual. So actually, when you are praised, when someone is telling you are the best, so you should do that. You should achieve that. You should say go for another job. You should go for a promotion. So likewise, we are actually motivated. Someone is telling, okay, you are the best person. You should go for a promotion. You should apply for the next promotion. So likewise, we are being promoted. Sorry, we are being motivated. But when we consider these kind of states, so this even doesn't have anything to promote, anything to motivate, anything to generate a self-view. So therefore it appears like boring. Therefore it appears like monotonous. And as you said, one may not think of going for another future life because there is no person to be born. So therefore, I mean, understanding the value of this requires certain amount of wisdom coming from the Buddha. So we have to trust the Buddha. Why he is trying to sort of emphasize here? Why he is trying to appreciate this kind of a mental state? So why, rather than neglecting such state, why he is asking us to preserve such state? So this is something that we can think of. So why, and the value that we give to something and the value that the Buddha give to something is entirely different here. So that we have to little carefully understand, and slowly we have to experience these states and familiarize with such state, then probably we would be able to understand the way Buddha is pointing out.
Thank you, Bhante. I believe that is all of the questions that I have received today.
Okay. Okay, then we can wind up the session. So some of you have have good questions and participated actively. And this sutta is actually more oriented towards the arising of wisdom. And this is especially say Dhatu Manasikara, the meditation on elements, is fairly arousing a lot of wisdom in our mind. And this whole Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta is opening up ourselves to a new understanding of Dhamma. So therefore, it's again and again interesting to look at these details and to try to understand what Buddha is trying to preach here. So with that concluding remark, then we'll wind up today's session. Thank you very much for participation, and we'll recite the traditional verses to share merits.